Matt Bosworth is professor of political science and public administration at Winona State University, a position he has held since the fall of 1997. His teaching and research are focused on various aspects of the United States of America's judicial system. For example, constitutional law, civil rights and civil liberties, and the First Amendment.
All right. Well, thank you all for the invitation to speak today. I do want to specifically thank John Collins and Cole Loniello and the Sunday Service Committee as well for helping to coordinate this talk. But I also see a number of familiar faces here, and again, I'm very glad to be here along with my wife, Jennifer Sanborn. Okay. Well, I know that my main topic here is the UU fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. But as academics are wont to do, I'd like to start with a digression. And I was wondering if anybody had any idea what the significance of today is. My main focus is the U.S. Supreme Court.
First Monday in October.
Well, you're right, actually, for tomorrow. That's right, the first Monday in October, so opening day, so to speak, of the Supreme Court term. But any significance for today? Okay, this is maybe a little bit more obscure, but in fact, this might be going on as we speak, although I'm not 100% sure about that. But there is about a 70-year tradition of the so-called Red Mass this morning, and this actually started in Paris in 1245, I think, in a Catholic church in Paris, in which the church decided to do a special service for lawyers and judges and those who toil in the courts of justice, okay, in which I guess all the religious officials would wear red. Okay. Again, known as the Red Mass, tradition went over to England about 200 or so years later, although the English might not admit that they got it from the French, but leaving that aside. Okay. My understanding is that this tradition goes on today in England of the Red Mass. The tradition carried over to America starting in the 1950s, 1952, 1953 or so, that there was a church in Washington, D.C., St. Matthew's, that put on the Red Mass and invited the Supreme Court. Okay. And so, in fact, actually, that there has definitely not been perfect attendance over the years, but I believe pretty much every year that at least some justices have attended the Red Mass. Okay, and by the way, that these would be some of the Catholic justices on the court, but not limited to the Catholic justices. Apparently that the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg attended for at least a little while, although apparently one year the sermon was so anti-abortion that she decided not to attend again. But last year, that Chief Justice John Roberts attended, Justice Amy Coney Barrett attended, and Justice Stephen Breyer, even though he's Jewish, attended, I think just because he likes to be invited. Okay, but yes, that this is a 70-year tradition of basically the Supreme Court attending this religious service, particularly before the start of the court's term. Okay, so again, the main theme of this talk is going to be what the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large. And so, yes, that we do have expressions of religious faith, again, going on at this service, but also, of course, not democratically elected necessarily, but basically these government officials who are specifically invited to this particular religious service. So again, that this kind of, I guess you could say, combination or maybe even, you know, maybe tension between these two values. Okay. Now, again, back to the direct subject at hand. Again, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. I think probably most of us would say, yeah, those are two good things, right? The right of conscience, okay, as you use, we're in favor of that. And also the use of the democratic process. I think probably most of us are pro-democracy as well. So again, two good things. So how are they together in this fifth UU principle? Was it just random? these are as part of the committee process in developing these principles. Did they just go ahead and throw them together? Maybe. But at the same time, I know that this is my bias, right, as a Supreme Court, type of scholar. But I'm taking a look at this language in the UU Fifth Principle and looking at a long series of Supreme Court cases in terms of how to interpret rights of conscience on the one hand, say specifically through the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment to the Constitution. The Free Exercise Clause essentially says that the government should not regulate, prohibit free exercise. But at the same time, though, that government does want to regulate various issues that are going to perhaps implicate free exercise type of concerns. Okay, so how do we deal with, say, a lot of cases in which we've got free exercise on one hand, or at least conscience rights on one hand, and then democratically enacted laws on the other? Okay, it will not surprise any of you all, at least certainly will not surprise my wife, if I say, what's the answer? It depends. So what I'd like to do at this point is to maybe to give you at least some flavor of this, going through at least some of these cases in which these values might be in tension. Okay. You all may or may not be familiar with a case about 80 years ago during World War II, West Virginia versus Barnett, probably better known as one of the flag salute cases. That is where basically, in this case, West Virginia had passed a law that required all school kids in public schools to pledge allegiance. And again, keep in mind that this was during World War II. Okay? Whereas the Barnetts were Jehovah's Witnesses. And essentially that saluting the flag to them was bowing down to a graven image, which was against their religion. Okay. By the way, that this was not a trivial issue, because that if one violated the West Virginia law, then basically that the kids could be disciplined, and that even the parents could be disciplined to the point of perhaps taking away the kids. Okay. Now, by the way, the Supreme Court had actually heard a very similar case 2 years earlier to the Barnett case, in which that the Jehovah's Witnesses had lost. Okay, but in West Virginia versus Barnett, some of the same justices actually changed their minds and decided, okay, that in this circumstance that the rights of conscience were more important. That basically, at least not that the Pledge of Allegiance couldn't be said in the public schools, but that there needed to be some exceptions, that there needed to be some leeway for children whose parents, again, wanted them, not to have to comply. Okay, even though that there was a spirited dissent on the court, that the court ultimately ends up going for freedom of conscience. Okay. Now, if we fast forward, by the way, that I thought about, okay, that I know I'm going to have cases on either side. I was thinking, okay, if for the religious side, do I use this direction, and then for the non-religious side, that direction? Okay. So again, the religious side wins in West Virginia versus Barnett. If we move up ahead 18 years or so, we have a case called Braunfeld versus Brown, and that in 1961, where Pennsylvania had passed a Sunday closing law. Again, basically all businesses had to be closed on Sundays. Okay, the idea of basically giving a day of rest to the state. Okay. Now, this was a problem for Bronfeld because he was Jewish, and Jewish to the extent that he did not feel like he could have his business open on Saturdays. So essentially, the Sunday closing law meant that he was losing 2 days of business. Okay. He challenged this. He said that this is financially not viable. That he challenged this up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court basically said, no, sorry, tough luck. The law applies to everyone. And even if this is a problem for your religious beliefs, your religious beliefs aren't being barred, they're just more expensive. Okay, so one on this side. Okay. If we move ahead a couple years after Bronfeld, Sherbert versus Werner in 1963, Adele Sherbert was working, I believe, in a textile factory. But in any event, that basically her work schedule got shifted such that she would have to work on Sundays, which was against her religious beliefs. Okay, she quit and then applied for unemployment from the state of South Carolina. Okay, now this case, her case was not about whether she could get her job back. That she wasn't arguing about that. It was more about should she get unemployment. Because the state basically said she'd voluntarily quit, and so that basically she couldn't get it. Okay. The Supreme Court basically ends up finding for her and essentially saying that her free exercise rights were being violated here, that the burden on the state was not all that great to provide the unemployment benefits, whereas she had a serious religious convictions. Okay? And so Sherbert ends up winning, and not only that, but the court ends up applying a test known as strict scrutiny. And basically, it's a very high bar for the government to have to meet before it can significantly burden religious beliefs. So again, if you're going to burden religious beliefs with a law, then in order to apply that law to an individual, then you're going to have to show a really good reason for it. Okay, and the South Carolina had not shown a really good reason for basically denying her unemployment. Okay, so again, the strict scrutiny high bar, you know, comes out of this case. Okay, this strict scrutiny high bar was then applied a few years later in a case called Wisconsin versus Yoder. And this was a case involving the Amish in Wisconsin. Before this case, I had no idea that there were this many Amish in Wisconsin, but there are. Okay, but basically the Yoder family wanted to pull their kids out of school at age 14. Okay, apparently going to school, public schools was okay up to 14, but that basically 14 to 16 was a problem for them religiously. Okay, whereas that the state of Wisconsin required school attendance up to 16. Okay, so essentially that they're fighting over those 2 years. Okay, the case gets up to the Supreme Court. The court applies this strict scrutiny bar and essentially finds against Wisconsin and for the Yoders, essentially saying that this is a big burden on their religious beliefs, on their Amish beliefs, and that the state's interest in those 2 years for the kids is not large enough in order to be able to overcome it. Okay? So again, you know, this high bar, basically trying to protect the rights of conscience, the strict scrutiny bar. Okay? Well, if we move ahead to the 1980s, recall I was just talking about the Yoder case and the Amish. Well, that there was another case, U.S. versus Lee, in which an Amish person did not want to have to pay Social Security. Because the argument was that the Amish, well, we take care of our own, including our elderly. So we shouldn't have to pay into the Social Security system. Whoops, excuse me. And there the Supreme Court said, oh, hold on a second. Now there's money involved. Sorry. Taxes. Now, in fact, actually, the court did apply the strict scrutiny bar that we've just been talking about, but they said the government had cleared it. In other words, the government's interest in revenue collection and not having to set up a separate system for the Amish was so important as to say, yes, strict scrutiny applies, but that basically that the government has passed it so that basically the Amish still have to pay Social Security. Okay, so again, the free exercise claim here actually loses. Okay, that there are other cases, Goldman versus Weinberger, involving an Air Force medic who was Jewish, and he wanted to wear a yarmulke, okay, along with his military uniform. Whereas the military basically said that's not part of the standard issue uniform. You're not allowed to do that. Okay. He took his case up to the Supreme Court, and the court basically found against him. Okay. And why? Well, because this is the military. Because the military is different. So again, that they haven't gotten rid of the strict scrutiny bar, but that the religious claims were starting to lose for one reason or another. Okay, I'll give you one more case here in the 1980s. Ling versus Northwest Indian Cemetery Protective Association. So what was going on here is that there were lands in the Pacific Northwest that some Native American tribes considered to be sacred, including burial grounds. Okay, but that essentially the federal government wanted to help facilitate putting a logging road through those lands. Okay, and that case got up to the Supreme Court, and the court basically says that the Native Americans lose. Why? Because it's federal land. That is, that the Native Americans don't actually own the land, even though that they considered it to be sacred as part of their religion. Still, the fact that it was federal property. Again, that they're not getting rid of the strict scrutiny bar, but that they're saying that the free exercise claim loses. Okay, does that make sense so far? Okay, well, now we get to Employment Division versus Smith in 1990. Okay, and that this was a case involving two Native American drug counselors in Oregon. And that basically, as part of their Native American religious beliefs, that they used peyote. Okay, and apparently somebody at work found out about it. Apparently that this was a violation of their employment, that is drug use, as drug counselors. Okay, so that they were fired. Okay, they then, this isn't about whether they could get their jobs back. They apply for unemployment, okay? And the question is basically whether Oregon should give them unemployment or not, okay? You would think, based on the Sherbert case that we talked about earlier, that the court would apply strict scrutiny and that they would have a pretty good case. Well, in Employment Division versus Smith, that the court basically got rid of the strict scrutiny bar. And basically said, no, the only issue should be, was the law neutral and of general applicability? In other words, does the law apply to everybody equally? And by the way, here would be the law would be the criminal law against peyote, because Oregon did have a criminal law against peyote, which did not have a religious exception. Okay, by the way, even though actually the federal law does, but for religious exception, but the Oregon law did not. Okay, so basically, and this was the late Justice Scalia, actually. So again, not a liberal, but basically wrote this opinion for the court in Employment Division versus Smith, saying that the only test is there a neutral law of general applicability? Okay, that basically anything else would give special rights for religious people. Okay. Now, again, this would be more the use of the democratic process, right, in the use of in society. Again, democratically elected law in Oregon. Well, actually, speaking of the democratic process, Congress was not too happy about the Smith decision. Okay, and in fact, actually, both liberals and conservatives in Congress were not happy about the Smith decision. Okay, that conservatives were not happy because more of the religious rights, that they wanted religious rights basically to have higher protection. They wanted to go back to the strict scrutiny test. Okay, liberals in Congress also wanted to go back to the strict scrutiny test because they figured, okay, in practice, whose religions are going to get burdened? It's probably going to be more minority religions, right? In other words, the majority will protect themselves through the democratic process against this type of law, but it's going to be more like, say, the Native American tribes and other smaller religions. Okay, maybe you, but who are going to basically get burdened here. And so basically both liberals and conservatives came together in Congress. It was possible. Okay, and that they ended up passing the so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA. Again, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So basically restoring the strict scrutiny test. Okay, again, all of this was in the early 1990s, the debates over RFRA. Okay. Now, that there was a later on case that we don't need to get into the details here, but basically where the court says, yes, RFRA is a valid law, but only regarding the federal government, not state or local governments. Okay, you might just have to take this as a given. I'll answer questions afterwards. Okay, but yeah, basically RFRA does apply, but only against the federal government. Okay. Now, more recently, that you all might have heard a little bit about a case involving Hobby Lobby. Okay. In fact, I mean, you know, I grew up in Oklahoma where that there was a Hobby Lobby store not that far from my house. I just thought of it as an arts and crafts store. Okay. But yes, in the Hobby Lobby case, apparently that the founders of Hobby Lobby, the Green family, are very religious, and that they had a problem with a part of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, which required a minimum set of coverage for medical procedures, insurance coverage, which would include some forms of contraception. Okay? And so that the Greens and Hobby Lobby essentially said that us having to cover these forms of contraception is a form of abortion, which is against our religious beliefs. Okay? So they ended up suing, and essentially the part of the question is that basically can corporations like Hobby Lobby assert free exercise rights? Do corporations have religion, so to speak? Okay, so that case gets up to the Supreme Court, and the court applies RFRA, again, that this law that Congress had passed, to say, well, now the bar is strict scrutiny again, and Hobby Lobby wins, because that the government has not shown an important enough interest, okay, in making sure that the contraceptive coverage is there. Now, I, to be fair to the court majority here, that part of their rationale was that the government itself had already offered accommodations to other types of religious institutions to say, if you don't want to cover contraceptive, we'll cover it for you. So think like, for example, like religious schools. Think like Notre Dame, for example. At Notre Dame, are all the employees Catholic? Are all the students Catholic? No. And so that basically what the Obama, and this was the Obama administration initially, had offered institutions like Notre Dame was to say, if you don't want to have to pay for contraceptive coverage, we'll pay for it for you. OK. Okay? So in the Hobby Lobby case, the Supreme Court majority basically said, well, you should have to offer the same deal to corporations. Since you've already shown you can do that, you should also do it for corporations that have these religious beliefs. Okay. By the way, that there was a spirited dissent from the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on this one. Okay. But again, the majority ends up going for Hobby Lobby, and again, more on the conscience side. Okay. Does that make sense so far? Okay. All right. Well, more recently, that you all have probably heard a little bit about the Masterpiece Cake Shop case from Colorado. Again, the LGBT couples who wanted to have a wedding cake made. And long story shorter, the Supreme Court ended up ducking in that case. That is, technically, the baker ended up winning. But it was not because that the baker would always have a right to refuse service. It was more that the court majority focused on comments made by Colorado civil rights agency officials during the process that they said were discriminatory against religion. Okay. So again, one or two of the agency officials apparently had said some things during the process that were basically critical of religion. And that's what the court, well, okay, I was going to use the word seized on, but focused on as a way of saying, okay, that this was religious discrimination against the baker, which is why he should win. But we're leaving the broader issue up to the future. Okay. Of course, more recently, that the court has had cases about COVID and religious services. That is, lots of local governments around for the last few years have been passing laws saying, okay, for public health reasons, to try to limit the spread of COVID, that you're not allowed to gather in groups of X number or more. Okay. That there were some of these cases appealed up to the Supreme Court, and even though the court was not uniform on this, by and large, the court ended up finding for the religious groups. Okay? And essentially saying, okay, that you should have to pass, okay, that they didn't actually say strict scrutiny directly. They didn't overrule Employment Division versus Smith. They didn't overrule the Peyote case. But that they were being very solicitous of the religious groups who wanted to be able to meet. Okay, and essentially that they adopted what one scholar has called the most favored nation approach to religious groups. That is, that basically if the government is allowing anybody else to meet, the religious groups have to be allowed to meet too. So if they're allowing bike shops to be open, they have to allow church services to go on. Even though that there might not be like X number of people in the bike shop singing at any one time, but still the court says, well, if you allow other groups more flexibility or other entities more flexibility, you need to do it for the church service as well, for the religious service. Okay, so again, I mean, not overruling Employment Division versus Smith, but heading in the kind of the upward direction. Okay, let's see that there was another case from Philadelphia about LGBTs and adoption. In other words, that basically could a Catholic group in Philadelphia still participate in an adoption program, even though that they would not adopt for LGBT couples. And the court basically found a way of ducking that one. Okay, still actually finding for the Catholic group, but ducking the broader issue. Okay. Much more recently, you all may have heard a little bit about this, that the court just this last term had a case called 303 Creative versus Alenis, which was a case involving I use the term a little loosely, but a woman who designed websites for weddings. Now, I'm using the term a little bit loosely because apparently she had never actually designed a website for a wedding. But she wanted to. And apparently for the court at this point that was enough. Because she said, if I design a website and an LGBT couple comes to me wanting one, I won't do it because of my religious beliefs. Okay. Now, technically, well, that her case came before the court, that there obviously was a religious issue here, but that there was also a free speech issue that she's raising, because she says, well, it's a website, it's words. You're forcing me to censor, or essentially to change what words I'm using, so that also violates my free speech rights. Okay, whereas, and again, we can get into all the hypotheticals. Basically, is a website speech? Maybe so. Is a cake speech? Is a haircut speech? These types of questions. Okay. So, long story shorter, the Supreme Court does end up finding for her, Lori Smith, and the owner-operator of 303 Creative, although, again, technically on free speech grounds, saying that the state, even though Colorado had a general anti-discrimination law that would protect LGBTs, that her free speech rights would outweigh that. So, again, more on the rights of conscience side. Okay, so again, even though that the court had taken down the higher bar in the Peyote case, it's been going up higher and higher and higher and higher again. Okay, the last specific case that I'll mention here is actually a case that has been appealed up to the Supreme Court, but the court has not decided whether to take it or not yet. Okay, and that this is a case called Tingley versus Ferguson, but it involves a state law, and you all may be somewhat familiar with this from California, but this was a Washington state law, a law that bans conversion therapy. So in other words, that basically therapy intending to turn LGBTs into heterosexuals. Okay, so again, California and Washington state have banned such therapy. By the way, the way that this plays out is that actually Tingley is the therapist who wants to provide conversion therapy, okay? And he's not facing jail time, but he would be facing the loss of his license, okay? So that if the court were to decide the case, and by the way, apparently that he must have lost at the lower court because he's the one who's appealing here. Okay, that is that the lower court, the Ninth Circuit, must have upheld the Washington state law, saying, yes, you can lose your license for practicing conversion therapy. So he's appealing up to the Supreme Court that the court is being asked by his lawyer, if please take our case, find for our client. Oh, and by the way, if you could just overrule Employment Division versus Smith, that would be great. So in other words, basically go back to the strict scrutiny test more formally, okay, for free exercise cases. So what is the court going to do? We will see. Okay, but that's essentially, but they should say one way or the other as to whether they're going to take the case sometime, at least in the next few months. Okay, but again, hopefully with this talk, I mean, at least I've given you all, okay, some cases on both sides of the line. Okay, but to say, okay, that these values, again, about the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, again, they're both really great values, very important, but at the same time that there can be tension between the two. Okay.
Regarding the Hobby Lobby case.
Yes.
Okay. That's very interesting. Does that feed into First and 14th Amendments? You know, the idea of a corporation being considered a person under the law and therefore possibly being able to therefore express religious views?
Yes, that's right. And I would say the whole issue of corporate personhood is a good question. And it's not surprising that it's complicated. That is, that basically, do corporations have constitutional rights? And the short answer is it depends. It depends upon which constitutional rights. That the court in Hobby Lobby seems to be saying they do have free exercise rights. That in another case called Citizens United on campaign finance, the court has said that they do have free speech rights under some circumstances. They do have, under some circumstances, Fourth Amendment search and seizure rights, but they don't have Fifth Amendment self-incrimination rights. In other words, that they can't say, you can't make us turn over our records because that will incriminate us. No, that's not allowed. Okay, I don't know that a corporation would have privacy rights, the way the court has interpreted right to privacy. So again, would they have Second Amendment rights? Fortunately, I don't know of any cases on that. Right to keep and bear. Yeah. So in other words, it basically is, yeah, that they would have some of these 14th Amendment rights, so to speak, but not necessarily others. Yeah.
I have a question about, what became really interesting was when you were going through time with this, I felt like I understood the decisions at a certain point, up until 1980, and then when it actually dissolved around that, messy in some ways, because they dissolved that law, or?
Yeah, it's hard to say, because, it's a good question. I mean, I would say that maybe part of the confusion is that, again, I mentioned with Employment Division versus Smith, the Peyote case, and then the congressional reaction to it, is that basically, again, both liberals and conservatives were kind of together on this. And as a matter of fact, the dissenters in Smith were the liberals on the court. The people who were arguing for greater free exercise of religion in the Smith case were the liberals, by and large. Okay? And so, but who's been trying to use RFRA ever since? It's been, at least politically, people who are more on the conservative side of the spectrum. So again, then maybe that's part of the confusion as well, is that Smith in practice has worked out differently than it would have anticipated at the time. And again, it's not often that political liberals say we should be reaffirming the decision by Antonin Scalia, again, who is generally known as one of the most conservative justices on the court, but that's pretty much where a lot of liberals are at this point.
Matt, I have a more foundational question. Is the Supreme Court legitimate or credible in light of all the revelations about Clarence Thomas? And in defense of Clarence Thomas, it's not just him. Ruth Bader Ginsburg also had a number of highly paid speaking engagements and trips. Is it credible and legitimate in light of, this is not an elite group of jurists who operate above the political fray. They literally get paid by some of the country's wealthiest donors. And follow-up question, so is it legitimate? Secondly, is there a way for them to police themselves, to create any kinds of high standards so that the public can again have any sense of trust that they're going to be fair and impartial in this process?
I take it you're giving me the easy ones here, right? Yes. Yes. No, good questions. I mean, and I would say in terms of the legitimacy issue, I mean, I can tell you that it is a real concern. I mean, just from a political standpoint, that if you take a look at public opinion polls about the approval rating, so to speak, of the Supreme Court, it is at a decades-long low right now. In other words, that fewer people think that the Supreme Court is doing a good job these days than they have in decades. Although I will point out that the Supreme Court's approval rating is still twice as high as Congress. So a lot of it does depend upon where is the bar here. Okay. But it's a real concern. I think it's definitely a concern that is shared by a lot of the justices on the court, which is why that they're giving speeches about how, basically, at least on the conservative side, why you should trust the Supreme Court, why you should trust their decisions. I think that Chief Justice John Roberts has always been worried about the court's legitimacy. And that on the liberal side, that there have been a number of dissenting opinions recently in which the liberal justices have said decisions like the majority is using, like on the abortion issue, but only that's only one example, that these types of decisions do kind of make it look like we're just making it up as we go along. wrong and we're being political. So I think that pretty much everybody on the court is somewhat concerned about that. And this is also a big concern because, okay, if we go all the way back to the Federalist Papers and Alexander Hamilton, Hamilton says, well, the court is going to be the least dangerous branch. That's literally the words that he uses, the least dangerous branch. And why? Because they have neither the power of the purse nor the power of the sword. That is the power of the purse, power over taxing and spending, that's Congress. That the power of the sword, obviously, is the power of the military, the executive branch, and that's the president. What does the court have? Basically, the court is powerful because we believe it's powerful. The court is powerful, basically, if we accept their legitimacy. Because otherwise, they're basically just nine people in Washington. Okay, and so yeah, how do you best preserve that legitimacy? Now, granted, I mean I suppose that one answer is, well, to what extent are they legitimate? Well, they are the Supreme Court. They're sitting in Washington. They are deciding the cases. And what's the alternative? However, I would say that there is a role here to play by Congress. That, in fact, Congress can regulate the Supreme Court, and in fact has regulated the Supreme Court for the last 200 plus years in one way or another. By the way, that including even how that we think about the Supreme Court as having nine justices, that's not in the Constitution. That the Constitution says nothing about the number of justices. That's up to Congress. That they started out with six. Why did they pick an even number? I don't know. Okay, but yeah, that, and in fact, actually, it's been as high as 10. Briefly during the Civil War, make sure that Lincoln and the North had a majority of justices. And then it went back to 9 after the war, and that's where it's stayed ever since. Okay, and I could get into a whole lot of other issues about Congress regulating the Supreme Court and the federal court's jurisdiction, which we don't want to do here today. Okay, but yeah, that in fact, actually, Congress can step in and regulate the Supreme Court to a significant extent, that there are legitimate concerns about, okay, at what point would they violate separation of powers? But I think that basically Congress has done nothing for the last 35 years. And regulating the Supreme Court, there's a lot of room for them to be able to step in. Or at least, well, one idea that I heard was that basically maybe could you tie funding for the federal courts now that their salaries can't be reduced. That's actually in the Constitution. Okay, but could you tie some funding for the federal courts into adopting an ethics code for the Supreme Court? Now, I mean, is that the right idea? I'm not sure. Honestly, but just to say is that there is room for Congress to step in here, and I think ultimately, given the Constitution, given the system that we have, that probably is going to be the best solution, if Congress is willing and able to do that.
Does the First Amendment grant us freedom from religion? And if so, then how can contraceptive coverage be denied on religious grounds?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And again, if you go back to the language of the First Amendment itself, and this is where I want my pocket copy of the Constitution, but I believe it says something like, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Okay, so the so-called Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. So the First Amendment explicitly provides, yes, that there can't be an official religion, but you can't bar the free exercise. Again, both of those are two good principles. And oftentimes they're going to be working together, except when they don't. And so, yeah, and the problem is that basically if you read free exercise rights broadly, at one point do your free exercise rights start getting into a government accommodation of religion or establishment of religion? But if you separate government and religion too much, at what point do you then start to infringe on people's free exercise rights? so that there's going to be a tension there. Yeah, and so that and yeah, back to your specific question about contraception and Hobby Lobby and all of that, that the court, for better or for worse, was focusing more on the rights of the corporation rather than the rights of the employee. And that's essentially what the late Justice Ginsburg was talking about in her dissent. Basically, where do the rights of the employees come in here? But that was not the majority's focus. And okay, that they didn't actually say this, but to a certain extent, implicit would be it's the owner's rights that are important. And if you really don't like it, you should get another job. Which again might not be a satisfactory answer, but I think that that's the answer the court would give. All right. Well, thank you all very much for your attention and questions.